This is a production of Cornell University.
My name is Margaret Washington. I'm a professor of history here at Cornell. And it's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker. Most of our pioneers are still eating over in the Statler, and I'm sure they'll be here soon. But I think we should get started at any rate. Tricia Rose is currently professor of Africana Studies at Brown University. She is the author in 1994 of the award-winning book Black Noise, Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America. This is a groundbreaking work that is, I certainly use it, and it is widely cited and widely read. In 2003, she authored an oral history of Black women's sexual lives, Longing to Tell, Black Women Talk About Sexuality and Intimacy. This is an inspiring and a heartwarming and also kind of a heartbreaking story of marginalized women told in their own words. Dr. Rose has returned to hip-hop, and her new book is entitled The Hip-Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip-Hop and Why It Matters. Now, that was scheduled to be out by Basic Books in 2008. Is it? It's out?
December 1st.
That's soon. Tricia Rose is a native New Yorker, born and raised in Harlem in the Bronx. She took her BA in sociology from Yale University and received her PhD in American Studies from Brown University, where she currently teaches. She also taught at NYU. Besides being a noted scholar, she is a widely acclaimed lecturer on American and African American culture, politics, race, and gender. She is a featured commentator in radio and television, and her articles have appeared in the New York Times, The Village Voice, Essence Magazines, among other magazines and journals. So please join me in welcoming Tricia Rose.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm very, very happy to be here. This is a really interesting and dynamic event, and I'm happy to be here at this particular time because I have decided recently to sort of re-engage in what I suppose Mark Anthony Neal would call hip-hop studies in a way that I hadn't directly in print done. So as Professor Washington just mentioned, I do have a new book out, which there are two copies in the world of, and I brought it. So that it's not a joke, it's not real till you can hold it in your hands, and I might, depending on how things go, read a very small section of it to you, but it is slated for to come out about a month from now. This is a wonderful event, as I said, for many reasons. I have both long-term colleagues and friends like Professor Neal and Jeff Chang and ex-students who are working here now like Paula Ioannidi at Ithaca College and new and friends I've met recently, Carol Boyce-Davies and other sort of multi-generational people in conversation is just very important. I want to speak, before I talk about the hip-hop wars and why what I have to say about that and what I think the future of hip-hop has to be about, I want to talk a little bit about this importance of archiving and situate it in the context of thinking about our role as critical historians, as critical thinkers about our lives and the lives of the people around us. There's nothing more important than having knowledge about one's past and that knowledge to be connected to the power and social structure of that past. That it's not just facts about the past, but the past as a living object for reflection. Archives allow this in a particular way, and they're extremely important. But they also produce often a celebration and a form of memory that can hide as much as it reveals. So I want us to think about archiving as a political practice that we have to stay engaged with, not as a decision that is about filing, as it were, gathering and filing, but something much more complicated than that. One of the concerns I have really about hip-hop right now is what I perceive to be as a real reduction in serious critical challenging, both in the commercial sphere of the music, the media sphere of the conversation, and I think that approach has actually trickled down even among academics who by trade like to argue for a living. And I think that one of the problems is that critical examination, when you're talking about something that people hold dear, is hard to do. The second reason it's hard to have a serious critical examination is that the context of poor people and people of color's creativity is sort of automatically, or as Althusser might say, always already under siege. So it's not a neutral context, right? It's a context where they have to figure out how to make themselves seen and heard as the precursor to the conversation. So that fact often means that a certain kind of critical engagement looks like it's getting on the bandwagon of an already existing process of marginalization. And so that, it seems to me, is one of the stumbling blocks here. On the other hand, we have to be very concerned at this historical moment about the degree to which the expansion and infiltration of the market economy, the degree to which it has dulled our critical consciousness as people across the world, but certainly for those of us who live much closer to the fire of that economy as opposed to the distant outposts. And so we have to, with love, of course, get at some not just truths as they might appear on the surface, but more complicated truths and more perhaps contradictory elements than a simplistic form of preservation might allow. In sense, I want to encourage the students here, the faculty here, the writers here, the public intellectuals and thinkers here of all stripes and professions, to imagine that the fifth element to which our extraordinary pioneers were speaking is really also an intellectual challenge. It's not just the fifth element of the knowledge about early hip-hop, but the fifth element about knowledge about the context for what we're doing, and that the drive for the fifth element is actually the new frontier. That it's not really any more about knowledge of origins as much as it is about the politics of knowledge in this moment, because tomorrow is going to be determined by what we're doing now. So I'm very forward-looking, and in a sense, I perceive my challenges to the public conversation about hip-hop right now to be very much about taking the pioneers as seriously as possible. This idea of knowledge to guide us is really critical, and it's in that spirit that I come to it. As my bio indicates, I'm from New York. I guess I was saying to Mark earlier, you have to apparently be from the Bronx to come to this conference or something. They must have done a special test. I don't know. Jeff's not from New York, is he? So he's our one. It's good though. You have to have someone from outside New York. It's important. And I wish I was on the bus from the Bronx that came here, but right now I live in Providence, so that would be an unfair journey to give to them. But I have very complicated roots in hip-hop in that I'm from the Bronx. I'm from the Northeast Bronx, Co-op City. Actually, when I learned that, that the Cross Bronx Expressway, like Co-op City was where a lot of people who were displaced because of the Cross Bronx Expressway were moved. Of course, I didn't know that till I had lived in Co-op City for like 18 years. It just all made perfect sense in ways that were unclear to me then. But the fact that both Co-op City and the Cross Bronx Expressway have become these very important icons for hip-hop is really fascinating to me as a native New Yorker. Now, I was not a B-girl in the hip-hop sense of the word. I was a B-girl in the sense that I was an athlete in high school and really wanted to be a hooper, but this was a long time before women would even be. I don't even want to discuss age, but the point is, it's like a really long time ago. I mean, it's before anyone even could put the W in front of NBA. Like, it's like before Nancy Lieberman. Okay, they conjured her up to come to my, you know, athletic awards ceremony as like the one female basketball player in the global world. You know, it was just like, well, who is she? You know, she was like some dinosaur they trotted out. In any event, I say that because my social space around athletics was spent in the summers when I had time, was really spent watching hip-hop in local non-performative spaces, meaning not so much going to big parties and big block parties, but also how people practice their craft on the perimeter of the basketball court, because that's really a lot of where it also went on, something that we haven't talked about here, that it wasn't only going to jams or being invested as a serious, you know, MC or DJ, but about bringing your double cassette player, you know, with your B-side of some song already taped, and then, you know, you'd bring the other side so you could tape the new rhyme you were working on while you were waiting for a game to open up, right? So there's that kind of not so much hip-hop as a segregation from other parts of youth culture, but as something that was mixed in with everyday practice. I wrote a paper about hip-hop, or at that point what I thought of as rap music, because that was really what I was interested in college at Yale, when this is, you know, again, early 80s. And then decided to go to graduate school to work on hip-hop. That wasn't my thesis. I had a thesis on some whole other matter, because, you know, it was like you wouldn't write your thesis on hip-hop. But I did write this paper, and so Black Noise really is my thesis in revision. And it was a labor of intellect and of heart, for sure. To this day, I'm very grateful that I took an ethnographic approach and that I chose to document and interview a lot of various pioneers, not the ones here, although I've met several of them many times, but others, people like Crazy Legs and Wiggles and Carmen Ashurst and Red Alert and Kool Moe Dee and, you know, et cetera, Queen Latifah and MC Light, Salt and Pepper, blah, blah, blah. Because this question of getting people's voices into the story is very important. But I was also interested in analyzing in a way that stories don't alone do. So stories do a particular work, but there's other work to be done. And one of the things that drew me to hip-hop was its challenge to musical rules. I was profoundly impacted intellectually and emotionally by the excitement of the challenge to traditional musical rules that seemed pretty much to come easily. The innovation and the innovative use of technology. You see this in jazz, you see this in the transition of rural to urban blues, but the way it takes place in hip-hop is fairly extraordinary. The power of telling stories, the ability to make what scholars eventually call, and labor studies did this as well, prestige from below. How do you develop a system of value and appreciation when you're in a community that is not publicly valued? When you look at Joe's photographs and you see what the South Bronx was as a sign of society's abandonment of people, what does it mean to take that abandonment and reject at least as much as possible the internalization of that abandonment, and to, in a sense, reinvest in the self when others don't seem to be willing to make that investment and are, in fact, divesting. But there is a romance to the way we talk about early hip-hop. A lot of what's wrong with commercial hip-hop now has its origins in everyday society, which has its origins in early hip-hop. So we can't act like a lot of what we see now that's wrong with commercial hip-hop was invented in a boardroom somewhere. It was not. Vicious forms of misogyny and sexism existed in everyday life. They exist in everyday life, and hip-hop is part of that process. Not everyone left gangs to participate in hip-hop. Some stayed in, and some still continued to participate. And the culture of a kind of hustling narrative and culture is still a part of that community and was at that time. But I would say that we are in a new moment, that what the pioneers articulate about an ethical worldview, about community, about a sense of possibility, about investing in others when it's a sacrifice to do so, that moment really dramatically begins to fall away, and a narrowing of representations and politics begin to take place in what I would call commercial hip-hop, in the mid-1990s in particular. And that is a profoundly important facet of the commercial explosion of hip-hop. They coincide entirely. And they have actually contributed to the burying of the pioneers. I mean, when you think about, this is not the lecture, but when you think about jazz, for example, and the way pioneers and icons from 40, 50, 60 years ago are still touted as central, seminal figures for artists' development. You think about the way Ellington gets talked about, the way Coltrane gets talked about, the way Miles gets talked about among many younger jazz musicians. That kind of direct homage does not happen as easily in hip-hop, partly because it's so much about, in some cases, bragging and toasting and self-identification as the baddest so-and-so in the history of whatever it is. but it's also about this inability to speak to the spirit of that moment because it is in such direct contradiction to what has happened in commercial hip-hop. So while there were problems, I want to situate what I think's going on in commercial hip hop since the mid 1990s, not to claim that none of this went on before, but to say that certain of those elements became the core market products for commercial hip hop. And this commercial juggernaut has been tragically under-addressed in the scholarship, in the journalism. The artists do it on the margins, but they don't even get much attention for doing so. So what, to my mind, what's happened is that through a collusion of a variety of effects, most of which I couldn't possibly do in 45 minutes, we have wound up in a situation where the very kind of critical skills for battling, for challenge, for elevation and evaluation that hip-hop is known for has not been able to be executed in the public arena around the mainstream conversation about hip-hop. What we've done, and I think we're all culpable of this, so this isn't a me as opposed to others, is sort of relying on the heyday or relying on the formative years to frame the genre in perpetuity. So it's almost as if no matter what hip-hop does, it's got these great origins. So as long as we can talk about the dispossessed and the way in which it articulates human possibility and the way in which it transforms music, it doesn't really matter that the vast majority of what sells is a profound and insulting portrayal, particularly of black people, and contributes to an incredibly destructive sense of an absence of possibility. And the third most important thing is that it undercultivates, it decultivates, it prevents progressive political consciousness, the very heart of what hip-hop is actually about. And so this big mainstream corporate hip-hop that those of us who are progressive kind of, you know, you hold your nose or you're like, well, I'll get the clean version, or I'll find the good phrase, or I'll listen to the cuts that aren't on the radio because that must be what he's really about, right? Or I'll support hip-hop as a whole, but I'll only buy the underground, but I won't critique the big mainstream, right, becomes a strategy of really collusion with this process, not necessarily intentionally, and by all means not always consciously, but we in a sense run away from the power of the market to shape this generation of hip-hop consumers and future generations. We're not paying close enough attention to the impact on politics, on community, on male-female relationships, on homophobia, on male identity, on the celebration, what went from stories about, you know, struggling with the prison industrial complex to a badge of honor, the prison industrial complex being a tat, you know, as much as it is an experience that needs to be transcended, that pain gets pushed down for a constant celebration, and that transformation has a huge impact on hip-hop consciousness. Yes, there are hip-hop heads, you're all probably included among them, who know the history, who have an elaborate relationship to a variety of marginal artists. But in my honest experiences, both in the classroom at big famous schools and small underfunded schools, my experience talking to high school kids, my experience to going to concerts, is that most young fans today of all stripes don't know either the history of hip-hop or the history of economic exploitation, the history of black people, of black diasporic, which includes the Caribbeans, who speaks all languages. Those histories are not available to these fans, and they are instead being marketed to in such profound ways that they see the world as it is commercially presented for them in hip-hop. We cannot run away from that any further. It doesn't mean there are not other progressive energies, but I see myself actually enabling those progressive energies, enabling this underground, making it unburied. I mean, I don't really want an underground, you know, because who's underground? Dead people, right? I want that underground to be at the core of what goes on. That's not going to happen if I just keep tilling the earth over there, seeing how deeply they're buried, but I don't pay attention to who's creating the dump truck of dust and dirt and debris on top of them every time I clear a little bit. So I go, who do you really like now? Well, I like, you know, artist so-and-so. Let me go find her. And while I'm scraping away, you know, some fool standing above me going, why is she scraping? I'm about to just drop a whole 10 pounds of dirt right where she was scraping. And then I go back to scraping, right? That's really what we've all been doing to a certain extent. Not everybody, but I'm generalizing here to make a point that the public ideas and investment in hip-hop have been shaped primarily by corporate agendas and by mainstream artists' complicitness with that agenda. And youthful, cross-racial complicitness with a history of expectations about what it means to represent black people. And I'm going to make a point about saying black people here specifically. Because hip-hop is profoundly racially diverse, it's ethnically diverse, it's internationally diverse, it's religiously diverse, it's less gender diverse, but it's gender diverse, it's sexual orientation diverse, but that is not the hip-hop that everybody is buying. Let's keep that very real. They're buying T-Pain and Lil Wayne, and I could just keep going. Now, I'm not saying they're not talented, but they're not doing all this progressive marginal analysis that we're talking about, right? Nas doesn't sell the kind of records that Jay-Z sells. There's a reason for that. It's not that the man doesn't have skills and doesn't have musical talent. Nobody's really buying Eve. Nobody's buying the women MCs. Well, why? Okay, so the market that's really driving what happens is a different set of narratives, and they're based particularly on a ghetto fantasy about black masculinity and black femininity. For all of the diversity of hip-hop, everybody's being asked to trade on the legacy of the stereotypes of the pimp, the gangster, and the hoe. And he is not white, and he is not Asian, and he is not Puerto Rican. He is black in the imagination of mainstream society, and therefore in consumption patterns, and therefore in the images that we see. So we have to actually get very clear about the power of the distortion of blackness at the core of commercial hip-hop if we're ever going to break this fictitious black-white binary. We're not going to get it by just talking about the exceptions that are trying to do it. We have to actually face the core of this problem. So I make this argument that I call this the hip-hop trinity, the gangster, the pimp, and the hoe, which basically crystallizes a history of the stereotypes of black people with the actual lived experiences produced by a history of divestment. So you have a legacy of stereotypes which revolve precisely around the gangster, pimp, and the hoe. Because the pimp is basically a modern urban form of the sort of rapist slash sexual deviant. And the gangster is a violent, uncontrolled, perhaps entrepreneurial and stylish, but nonetheless irreconcilably different, irreconcilably outside black man. And the black woman is perpetually a hoe, basically. There to be the dump ground for a post sort of feminist world when sexism's no longer really part of mainstream popular culture in this kind of vicious way, but hip-hop gets to do it with a pass. I'd love to see an alternative rock song with half the lyrics, half the images that go on in the middle of the day that show black women as mindless, irrelevant, and as our amazing female pioneers yesterday pointed out, meaningful only insofar as they are, you know, gifted biologically with charming physical traits, that the rest of their talents are in fact unworthy of conversation and discussion. Those three images are really at the core of what's happening. Now again, I can hear you because I've had this fight for over 10 years. I hear you saying to me, some of you, well, but what about, and now we can fill in the blank. Oh, well, I don't listen to that. Or in fact, I don't really listen to the words. Now I've taught hip hop for a very long time and I've heard, I think, every possible excuse. Why do we need an excuse? Here's why we need an excuse. We need an excuse because the public conversation is so trapped in talking in oppositions, that public critique turns you into an anti-hip-hop speaker. The public conversation is polarized so profoundly between those who are pro-hip-hop and those who are con-hip-hop. Those who are on the left, as in their progressive, critical, trying to find what's, you know, radical about hip-hop, and those on the right, like McWhorter, who Mark pointed out earlier, but there are many others, he's not alone, who use hip-hop as an example of urban decline, of social decay, of the lack of, you know, creativity, of the decline of modernism. I mean, whatever it is somebody's upset about, hip-hop's pretty much responsible. And my favorite language for this polarization, players versus haters. I cannot tell you how many times if I say, well, you know, at what point are we going to make this critique about sexism? Well, you know, that's just what the haters do. You know, I'm just all about, you know, everybody's sexist, right? So then the same questions kept emerging. So over 10, you know, really since Black Noise came out, the first few years were one thing, but, you know, come 98, 99, I'm like, this is looking mighty different. I think we need to have a different conversation. But oh no, I mean, you basically became a hater. It got to the point where if I made a public critique, I figured, well, Black Noise should be clear. It's clear I'm not a hater. In fact, I was considered to be overinvested, so I couldn't possibly be a hater. But as soon as I'd make a critique, it was so polarizing, right-wing radio would start to call me. We understand you've given up hip-hop and you're ready now to talk about what hip-hop really is. You're like, well, who are you? I'm at such and such a radio station in Canada, and we heard, and they would be like, and I'd say, okay, well, hold on, let me call you back. I'd be like, hang up, go do my little research. Be like, why are you calling me again? Well, you know, we hear you, you know, basically you crossed over, you know, from the dark side. And this one time I thought, okay, that's an exception. But then it continued to happen. And I realized that there was a progressive responsibility that we had to create a space of what I call in this book transformational love in critique. And that is to say, not critique for the purposes of beating people up and isolating individuals who are responsible, but a critique that enables, right? Like, you need to work on your jump shot. That's not an insult. You just might need to work on your jump shot. It will get better. It will not get better if I tell you, oh, baby, you're so good. That, you know, and you know, it's just because that basket's not pretty. That's why your jump shot ain't going in. And also, you know what? You need more lines on your court. And if you had air 360 airs in your shoe, you would do a whole lot better jumping for that jump shot. I mean, look, the basket's whack. Your sneakers might need some, you know, tape. You still got to make your jump shot. Now, that kind of critical engagement, a sense of like, look, I'm recognizing your conditions. I understand the circumstances that you're in. But that doesn't change the fact that we have to do better. The pioneers didn't say, let's just figure out how to embody what we are being given, which is nothing. We're going to make something out of that nothing. And we're going to make something meaningful and possible and what? Peace, love, happiness, unity, when we have no reason to be happy if we follow the statistics. We have no reason to have unity given what's been bequeathed to us, and there's definitely no peace in a city that looks like Dresden. So how do you envision, right? You envision because you don't stand where you are and accept it. You do as Roxanne says, I am this today, but tomorrow I'm something else. So it's that vision of possibility that transforms it. Instead, our public conversation is polarized by pro-con, as I said, player-hater, left versus right. And so both the corporate media has both taken charge of the music in many ways in the mainstream, but it's also taken charge of the conversation. And that's partly why it's locked in this polarized battle. So I spent a lot of time just sort of responding to each debate as they came up, you know, and a lot of it had to do with sexism. And actually, I have to make a footnote here about this, because it's a bone to pick I've had really from the very beginning. And this is that I've been making a gendered critique as part of what I do in hip-hop from the beginning, not bashing men or celebrating women, but talking about the way gender plays out. It plays out in terms of public space apprenticeship. It plays out as to who's out late. These things came up in stories that got told, but they need to be gathered to show the impact of gender and sexuality for women in particular. But I am really struck by how much my contribution has been limited to the subject of gender. So for 10 years, now for a long, long time, there was nothing else. Nobody else had done a major technological intervention. Nobody else had done, you know, a sort of political intervention to that degree in terms of, you know, hidden transcripts and the politics of alternative language, all that. All the other chapters in Black Noise, 8 out of 10 times, could you come talk about gender at this conference? Because A, there wasn't anyone else they felt, or they thought it was like my job to do that, and it became a ghettoizing project inside of a ghettoizing project inside of a ghettoizing project. So I would say, well, who's talking about technology? And they would name some fool who hadn't written one single solitary word about it, or who was not a practitioner either, not an interviewer. And I'd be like, so why don't you let him talk about gender? He knows about as much about gender as he does about technology. Let him talk about that. Let him stumble around on women and masculinity. Why do I have to cover this one space so that I can be interpolated as only an expert on gender? For the purposes of what? Making more space for men, which is really a lot of what, unfortunately, hip-hop has been too much about. So it's like, no, actually, I'm authorized to speak about all of it, so you find somebody else to do the girls' work, because that's really what you're thinking of it as. So, you know, this is really another process of the way the politics of the world influence not just the practitioners, but also the intellectuals. So what happened is I would respond to debates, you know, as they came up. I would, you know, handle whatever was going on at the moment. And then I just was on, you have one of those conversations with a friend where you're just like out of your mind, you know, you're just grateful nobody's taping it. And you're like, blah, 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 blah. You know, and I'm like, it's like David Letterman. Somebody needs to write a book that just like the top 10 debates in hip hop and why they're so effed up. And I was like, right. It's like, okay, I gotta call you back. So I'm like, okay, well, what are the top 10 debates? What is everyone's? Because it became clear to me that the conversation was not only separated left to right, but it was driven by a repetition of excuses and blame. Blame, explain. Blame, explain. So the right wing blames, and I'll just give you a quick just summary of the subjects. The right wing blames hip-hop causes violence. Everybody says hip-hop doesn't cause violence. There's violence before hip-hop. Hip-hop reflects black dysfunctional ghetto culture. They basically act crazy. Hip-hop shows it. Look, they're happy to have a gat. They're happy to be drinking a 40, you know, and whatever it is. Look at them. Look at this. It's clearly dysfunctional. Who could argue for this? Hip-hop hurts black people, and this has been a real black middle-class response to hip-hop, that it's actually hurtful. This is not really a good thing in any way. The fourth one is it's destroying America's values. You know, that's really, you know, Bill O'Reilly's main claim to fame, that, you know, hip-hop destroys America's fundamental values. I'm not sure which ones those are, but I give you a sense of that in the book, what I think he means. Fifth is hip-hop demeans women, right? It's basically disrespectful. And this is, again, a complicated space because it's both true, but it's also not true in the way that it gets articulated. So that's the first five on the critics / haters / right wing side. On the hip hop defenders, the biggest, most powerful one, which you can use for everything, it's like the most malleable argument on earth, is that I'm just keeping it real. You can do anything under the rubric of keeping it real. You can't be queer, though, but other than that, you can do damn near anything under the rubric of keeping it real. I've never seen anything like it. So you gunned down your entire neighborhood in a fantasy. You sold crack to a six-month-old that you diluted I'm just making this up. The lyrics don't exist. I mean, oh, God willing. If these lyrics exist, this would just be the worst, like, prophetic fragment on earth. But, you know, so you put crack in a little just to get them addicted early enough, and then you say, look, I'm just keeping it real. Somebody's thinking that, or somebody wants to do that. So under the rubric of the fiction of reality, you propel a rhetoric and a worldview. So number six is keeping it real on the defender side, so that there is actually no other ground beside the imaginary reality that you've constructed, to which your music should be subjected, to which we should have standards for any reason. Another favorite one, hip-hop's not responsible for sexism. And as I say here, look, if we could find a fool who's responsible for sexism, bring him to me. But he don't exist because he's dead, right? The first person who came up with that's been dead. So, all right, we're clear on that. And? So I'm not responsible for global warming. Does that mean that I should constantly drink bottled water, you know, and throw 8,000 plus? Like, I didn't invent it, but I need to do something about it. So number seven is, you know, hip-hop's not responsible for sexism. And eight, this is my all-time favorite in the sense that it's my least favorite, although keeping it real is really ranked up there, is there are bitches and hoes. Now, this may sound funny, but I have heard one variation or another of this at all walks of life. You know, the bourgeois, the boulevard, everywhere, right? As if the power and privilege of labeling and defining black women, because it's usually about black women in particular, but not only, but labeling women in this way, both sexually and transforming their definitive personalities into labels, is a privilege that other people have. It's okay to have it. It's just perfectly reasonable. Nine is we're not role models. We're not role models, so we're not responsible for anything we say or do. Well, what are you, just products then? I don't know what you mean. You're a role model, and I go into this long analysis of what a role model actually is. It's not a perfect fantasy. It is, in fact, whether or not others in your immediate circle follow you in one way or another, good, bad, or indifferent. So whether you want to be a role model or not, you actually already are. So own the power of your modeling. I mean, it's not a choice that you are making. It's a circumstance that is going to happen. And the tenth is that nobody talks about all the positive in hip-hop. And, you know, what ultimately happens is I find that there is what I call a grain of truth in every one of these arguments, meaning that even on the conservative side, where you would automatically assume I wouldn't find a grain of truth if you're a hip-hop fan, because, of course, it's polarized, there is, in fact, a grain of truth in all 10 of these arguments. Sometimes there's a few grains of truth. It's not all even. But in fact, I think this is what I say in the book, is it's a grain of truth that is starving a nation of millions. That what we're doing is we're undervaluing what these arguments ultimately do to stifle the development of a progressive political consciousness to break us free. So it becomes an excuse. To say you're keeping it real doesn't make you ask the hard questions. To say hip-hop causes violence doesn't ask the hard questions and doesn't situate and historicize the context. So what happens is these become easy answers that shut down the conversation. They don't actually make us ask bigger questions, and they all share some very significant collusions. And so there's a whole other section of the book that talks about, after unpacking both the truth and what I think are most valuable and really problematic about all 10 of these debates, and I do that not because I'm trying to find the definitive answer, but because I see this as, again, a fifth element to say, here's what critical engagement on these issues might look like. Here's one model for what it means to really take this stuff seriously and to not fall for easy answers and to let others give you easy ways out in dealing with it. But there are mutual denials. You would think that, on the one hand, that there'd be nothing in common with the haters and the players. But the haters and players share a number of things, and so I spend a whole chapter on what they deny. They both deny the extraordinary power of corporate domination of commercial hip-hop. The pro-hip-hop heads will act like they're just authentic. They just write a rhyme, and there's no vetting, you know, and that the record company doesn't have any influence. I just say what's on my heart. How many times has Russell Simmons said, this is just what's on their heart? I'm like, man, please. So there's not a single black rapper who feels an anti-Semitic thought? But you know you haven't heard a record. They're all just profoundly misogynist. It's not that this sells more, right? There's not a queer rapper to be found in mainstream commercial hip-hop. Come on. So what's the collusion? The collusion is that the role of commercial modeling and values shape both sides of this conversation. The conservatives say this is authentic black pathology. See? We've been saying this for decades, and here's hip-hop, the fruits of this truth. And the biggest, most, you know, famous hip-hop artists and moguls and businessmen and journalists, I mean, it's like a whole cottage industry. On the other hand, they say, yeah, we're just keeping it authentic. This is exactly what happened. This is my story, exactly as it happened, because that's what sells. That story of the myth of absolute truth is part of the fiction. So they collide in denying the fact that the artists are being profoundly shaped in their narratives in many ways, but even more importantly, they're also being ripped off. Can't say anything, because you piss off the massa in the marketplace, and then you think you're being ripped off now, you're going to be really ripped off. You wind up like a pioneer up in here, right? Meaning that you can't even be part of the conversation. So they have to deny it just to stay close to the trough, and the right wing gets to consider the dysfunction. So the corporate denial, the deniability of corporate power here is a profound collusion in this conversation. I'm going to say one more thing about corporate stuff because it was part of, I forgot your name, son. What's your name again? Jordan's really fabulous segue was that into what's really at the heart of this project. This collusion around the silence of the role of corporate control of hip-hop is not just ideological. It's not just profits at the level of either record sales or, what's more important, is the marketing of secondary products. Because actually the records don't sell very much, but other things sell a lot more. And Jeff Chang's done wonderful work on connecting these things. They are actually much more important insofar as the control of the outlets of the culture. Now, 1996 was an incredibly pivotal moment. The Telecommunications Act of 1996, which was not intended to be directed toward radio, it was actually directed toward television, actually had the biggest impact on the consolidation of outlets for radio in the country. So what was previous laws prevented multiple owners of same either radio stations and or different mass media outlets in the same city. So if you had a newspaper, you couldn't have a radio station. If you had a radio station, you couldn't have a TV station. 1996 said, you can own everything. I'm exaggerating, but it's pretty close. So what did cats do? Cats with the biggest money, corporations that already had a lot of capital, they bought. In Hip Hop Wars, there's a chart at the end that shows who owns all of these, you know, hot kiss so-called radio stations, and there's really only two owners nationally. There's one third one that has a couple, but it's Clear Channel and it's Radio One. Now, Radio One is run by a black woman, so this isn't about black ownership. You got to have black politics. You got to have a black radical consciousness. Skin color doesn't actually get you where you need to go anymore, tragically. So, who owns it? Two radio stations. If you turn on any major hip-hop station in any major city, Memphis, L.A., New York, Detroit, Chicago, Philly, D.C., Boston, I could just be here all day, New Orleans, basically where the vast majority of black people are, two companies own what happens. What gets played, how often it gets played, people have done research. The rotation of songs went from 40 times a week to the songs that are preferred. Let's not get into payola. I'm not even going to touch that right now. We don't have enough time. To 140 times a week. So you want to know why Lil Wayne's like a virus in your head? It's not just because it's some good beats and he's talented. He is very talented to me. I think he's a lyricist. The content, totally uninteresting to me, but in terms of formation of rhymes, I'm not going to lie, I think he's talented. But why is it a virus? It's a virus because you heard it probably, even if you're just getting in your car to go park it, 50, 60 times. This is like George Orwell. This is about top-down control. I mean, it's like an old-school problem. We're so busy thinking that everything's democratized and diversified, you can go get a blog on the web, that you're in fact not being plugged in right over here. So this is a profoundly important part of the conversation. Why? Because people who make that critique, they don't get in rotation. It's a whole system of belonging. And this is really important. Boy, I could be here all day. I'm about to stop, I swear. So the history of the importance of intellectuals, right? I mean, why this isn't just about, you know, waiting for the industry or waiting for the public sphere is that there's one particular role intellectuals have, and that is that until they get rid of tenure, which they're working on, but until they get rid of tenure, until they figure out how to fire us at, you know, all the time for what we think, which is supposed to not happen right now, we have an obligation to say unpopular things. And it's a political obligation. And it's an intellectual obligation. And if that means you gotta explain that just because a brother's from the hood, that he can also be part of the problem, is something we have to say now. To me, that's the unpleasant thing to say now. We also need to say that while hip-hop's not responsible for things, it has a profound grip on young black kids, and what they're gripped by is not Lupe Fiasco, to my great despair, but instead to someone like, you know, T-Pain, right? I mean, that the narratives, I'm sorry, the narrative, I'm gonna keep it real, for real, real. You know, that the narratives that they're gripped by are the narratives that they've been fed 24/7. That's not their fault. It's not even my fault. It's the way it is. So what we need to do is use this intellectual space to push. That doesn't mean to stand for certain politics and not be open to others. You still have to be willing to be in serious engagement. But we can't see this as, you know, celebration I mean, in other words, we can't be trapped as intellectuals into the same binaries that this public conversation is trapped in, which is that we have to celebrate, because if we don't celebrate, we're a hater, or we think jazz is better if we don't, you know, like, you know what, just not even deal with that. We have work to do. And so I really want to encourage all of you who are students and scholars of this to consider that particular role in ways that I think has really dropped away. You know, I talk about these collusions. There are several. Both sides are sexist. Nobody on the right is addressing sexism in hip-hop. They're just using this other kind of respect women language, which is a code for treat them nice so they can stay home and shut the hell up. Right? That's what that's about. I'm like, you don't have to respect women any more than you respect everybody else. Why are you singling out respect for women? Because you want respect to be about, you know, a kind of patriarchal, paternalistic protectionism. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the free, if women want to be sexually explicit without sexist internalization, that's their freedom. Paternalism doesn't enable that. So you can't give women a choice of be pure and patriarchally acceptable or be a hoe, because neither one of these choices are acceptable and progressive. So I talk about this collusion around sexism, the collusion around homophobia. Ain't nobody on the right wing complaining about homophobia and hip hop's like, homophobia? I don't know what you mean. So I go through all of these to say that while they are quite opposite positions in the arguments, they end up in a very similar place on some key issues. But so then, not to depress everybody too much, I talk about what I think are some important progressive energies and voices, but I also talk about how to think about those voices in a way that I hope doesn't turn us into, well, I just only buy this artist and I don't buy that artist, because in many cases there are incredible interventions by artists who otherwise I might have some problems with. So I try to encourage a more complicated reading of various groups, and then I try to think about what organizations are acting locally to do the kind of counter work, because a lot of this is about visibility and reception. And since dominant corporate mainstream conversations never bring these people on, you know, CNN will bring, you know, a handful of people, or Bill O'Reilly will bring a handful, but they don't bring the grassroots people who are actually doing the work to talk about what their experiences are. And all that does is polarize the left and the right. So if they bring Dyson, Michael Eric Dyson, who's brilliant, he's got to be the player. Right? They already got the hater, so he's got to be the player. So the conversation is trapped. He can't see it. He can make an apologia briefly. Yes, there's sexism, but there's all this amazing creativity. So we never actually deal with sexism, violence, destructive behavior in hip-hop because the right wing has controlled that form of internal self-critique, so we've given it over. And so you don't develop because you're trapped into an affirmative love, not a transformational love. So I talk about the meaning... Thank you. The meaning of progressive activism as a way to respond to this, and to not, this isn't about individual artists. I mostly pick on the most famous because I think they can take it. You know, it's fair. But I don't pick on them as individuals because it's not about them. This can happen again at any time. There is a post-hip-hop world. I know you don't believe it, but just like nobody talks about the blues right now in the mainstream culture, and just like nobody really talks about jazz, which is really an extraordinary crime, we need more jazz archives too, I might add, to this conversation. They will soon not be talking about hip-hop. And the thing they are talking about will have the same Achilles heel as hip-hop if we don't solve it. So this isn't just about hip-hop. It's about a politics of language, of understanding how race and racial supremacy and the politics of cultural devaluing and sexism and homophobia play themselves out in the cultural realm, in the intellectual realm, and in the social realm. And if we figure that out, it can't keep happening. Right? So the book is really driven toward this notion of how to develop a politics that helps you navigate this very slippery, dangerous terrain that's highly marketed, where your own community comes back to you in a product form and you swear it's yourself because it looks just like you, but it's like some crazy alien, you know, that is just dressed in a costume. Remember, you know, in Terminator, the silver guy just turns into whatever he needs to be. I mean, it's kind of like post-civil rights racism. You know, whatever it needs to be, it just turns into, but it brings the same core genetic makeup, right? And so that's what's happening with a lot of what goes on. The artists that get driven to the margins, the writers who get driven to the margins, they don't have space to make this critique in the public realm as much as they need to because it doesn't reproduce the fictions and myths that we perpetuate as a country on race, on gender, on sexuality. So in the last chapter, I have this thing called the six guiding principles, because I ultimately, people always say, well, what do we do? Who do we buy? Who do we don't buy? And it's ultimately about developing a political disposition. It's about developing a progressive consciousness. So I'm just going to read to you the number one, or it's not number one only because it's number one, but it just comes first, is the way that one of the strategies I think we need. And I say it because somehow something came up here that made me think this would be the right one. I can't remember right now because I'm all fired up, you know, but when I calm down, I'll remember. And the first one is beware the manipulation of the funk. So this is these are now in the last chapter, the top six, you know, sort of things that can help us figure out how not to get caught up in the madness, because again, it may or may not be hip-hop where we see it. On countless occasions over the past decade or so, I found myself listening, driving, or dancing to a song, yet only later really heard the lyrics. One such song was Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg's 1992 classic and unbelievably funky Gin and Juice. Another was 50 Cent's hit In Da Club. Unlike Mark, I knew there was a real problem with the marketing part, but I had heard the radio version, or somebody had given me they didn't give me the real version. In some cases, I was unaware of the words because I couldn't really make them out or translate the slang quickly, and that needed some research. And other times, I heard the clean version and then got depressed when I learned what the artist really wanted to say. At still other times, I was mostly listening to the music or merely letting the music, the style, and the swagger move me so completely that only the most oft-repeated phrases really sunk in. Once I really listened to the words and thought about the story being told, it was hard to know what to do. Respond to the funk and ignore the words? Reject the story and give up the funk that went with it? The moment I realized that I was being asked to give myself over to the power of the funk, which in turn was being used as a soundtrack for a story that was really against me, was a very sad day for me. I thought my feelings must be very much like Washington Post writer Lene O'Neill when she reached a turning point with the music, saying she could no longer sacrifice her self-esteem or that of her two daughters on the altar of dope beats and rhymes. Some people swear that they can ignore the words and just enjoy the music. No matter what gets said, they're not affected. The words don't matter. Now, you've heard this before, right? Or are just students telling me this? You've heard this before? Okay, just checking. I've asked a lot of my students if there was any limit, or my stepsons for that matter, but they don't even try to ring me. They know not to mess with me on this side. They're like, oh, okay. And I don't have any, I have the non-lyrical versions, Ma Zeet. They got a nickname for me. They're like, we have the non-lyrical, I'm sure. Right. It's just the beats, really just the beats. So I asked them, you know, and they say that the words don't matter, to show that they would always be down with hip-hop. And I say to them, well, but there's nothing that would make you reject it? No, I am hip-hop. I live and breathe hip-hop. Again, a phrase you must have heard. So then I'd ask them if a pro Ku Klux Klan performer came up with an incredibly infectious, funky, undeniable beat and rhyme, but that the words celebrated explicitly the domination of black people, would they just block out the words and claim that the words don't matter? This caused a problem with the philosophical worldview. Of course, a few would still say yes, because they were smart enough to know I was tricking them. But my point in drawing this analogy to them and to repeat it to you here is not to imply that hip-hop lyrics are comparable to white supremacist rhetoric in 400 years of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but to point out that we have a line to draw, and that we always draw a line, and that this isn't just about external government control. It's about community control. It's about community values and principles and ethics. And so I say it's not a free-for-all. Anything goes as long as it's funky situation, but rather a matter of recognizing that before we reach our limit, we are saying yes to what we shake our hips to. My analogy also reveals that once we have pledged allegiance to something, we will submit to excesses and a negative influence that, if expressed by others, would be grounds for self-defense. And that allegiance is reflected in American politics, right? The Taliban and the really radical right wing here are very similar. We don't see it because they're the enemy and we got to go blow them to high heaven, apparently. But once you're aligned with, say, the U.S., then anything that goes on in there is okay to a certain point. So this level of allegiance is something that we should really be careful about. Were this only about one bitty song that uses the word bitch, or one or two rhymes that use violence as its primary metaphor, or songs that produce and support forms of community destruction and exploitation. If only one or two relied on insults that, you know, again, have historical resonance and problems, maybe we wouldn't need to raise our defenses so high. But unfortunately, this kind of spirit has really become the lingua franca for commercial hip-hop. Yes, we can ignore some lyrics on occasion, and that's not all there is by any stretch. But when the music that gets played over and over and over at the clubs and on hip-hop-oriented commercial radio and BET and MTV is saturated with hustlers, gangsters, bitches, hoes, tricks, pimps, players, and stories that glamorize domination and exploitation and violence. And that's important because it's not just drug dealing as an alternative economy, which is important to understand its historical motivation for, but about the rhetorics of take advantage of the people nearest to you because they happen to be your market. Right? It's the internalization of that that is really at stake here. When this becomes the primary vocabulary for hip-hop itself, then the power of the funk has been manipulated. The life force of the funk that really people like Bambaataa has been so important in keeping alive, commercial hip-hop weds that life force to a death imperative. Black music has played an extraordinary role in the history of black people and in the world. It's helped to help people everywhere protect, nourish, empower themselves, challenge themselves, resist forces, and sometimes challenge ways in which their freedom was being denied. But it's also been just about a good time. But that good time has been driven by a sense of community, belonging, and possibility. Doesn't always have to be political by any stretch. We think of protest music as the only option here. I'm saying, look, you can party, you can shake your rump, you can drink, have a good time. No one's saying this has to be some horrible, depressed, you know, everybody wears gray. I don't know why I'm wearing gray myself. Everybody wears gray and, you know, is just very depressed because we have power to fight. You know, that's not what I'm calling for. But if the terms of having a good time are actually self-destructive, what's good about that? That tradition of political resistance that we often think is going to be boring, it lives on today, but it's under duress, and the funk has been manipulated. The funk, in many ways, I think what we don't understand is that the funk is the Achilles heel for lovers of black diasporic music. Right? I mean, once something's funky, it's really hard to resist it. I think unless you really understand that and appreciate that about certain kinds of music, you don't understand how easy it is to be manipulated. I cannot tell you how many songs I would just be into, and then I'd know that whole stanza was coming. And I'd be like, what am I going to do? Am I going to the bathroom? Am I going to change the words and try to be a radical audience participant in the making of the song? You know, am I going to just say there are, you know, people like that, but it just isn't me tonight. You know, what am I going to do, right? I mean, this to understand the pressure that puts on people who love the music has to be honored and understood. But our places of weakness, like the funk, they make us vulnerable. And they make us available to things that could injure us. But they also open us to our greatest places of connection. This is why the music must be revered, not discarded. But like any other powerful and compelling force, beats can be distorted. They can be used as a baseline for stories that undermine the spirit. Music comes from, but also makes community. So the question is, what kind of community do we want to make? And in this future of hip-hop, it seems to me, that's the central question. It comes out of community, it makes community, and what kind of community do we want to make? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rose. Okay, we will take about 25 minutes for questions. We started a little late. Would a couple of people come up to each mic? Please limit your question or comment to one, and so we can get as many people in as possible.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How you doing, Professor Rose?
How are you, Alfredo?
I'm doing all right. I wanted to ask, the hip-hop community has been damn near unanimous in their support of Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And given that reality, I want to ask, how do we begin to complicate notions of keeping it real within hip-hop culture when thinking about how Barack Obama might challenge our idea of diaspora, geography, masculinity, power, presidential politics, et cetera, et cetera.
So let me make sure I understand this. You want to know how the hip-hop community might respond to how Obama changes the game? In other words, how his presence might reflect on those issues you listed?
Or how his presence might help us complicate those notions of those really rigid definitions that you so eloquently laid out in your...
I see. Well, hold on. Let me think about that before I start talking. I think what's the big challenge to me, the hip hop generation, or if there's such a thing, which I also really challenge as an idea. But the big thing is going to be, avoiding the pitfalls of over-identification politics. I'm not saying identity politics because that's going to happen anyway. It's happening when people vote for McCain, and I'm tired of this being only that identity politics happen when it's queers, when it's Puerto Ricans, when it's, somebody else. It's, in fact, always happening. So, that's not going to change. But it can't be all that's happening. And so, Obama's going to do things that aren't necessary. I mean, I don't see how he couldn't not do things that will be worthy of challenge. Right. Once you take that kind of corporate money, you're indebted to them. He's not indebted to the Boulevard in the same way. And most of his conversations about poor people of color and suffering have been almost even-handedly articulating the need for bothers to be in the home and the need for reading and turning the TV off and public policies that might help. And that even-handed strategy suggests that they're equally responsible for the situation that people are in. And they're not equally responsible for the situation that they're in. So there really is going to have to be, at some point, I expect, a challenge to some things. On the other hand, how will he become potentially, in the way I was using it, a role model, right? That institutional sources of power are maybe not always them. If they're us, then what does that mean about who we intend to be and how we might participate? Hopefully, those questions will come up with him. But people have an uncanny ability to create exceptions and differences that help them maintain where they are. And that's all of us, myself included. So the ability to transcend that's going to take some work. But I think it opens up a lot. Thank you. That's a really interesting question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a comment, but thank you again for your, it was absolutely wonderful. And I just want to encourage everybody who is passionate about hip hop to really think about getting engaged about the causes of some of the things that she's talking about in the corporate ownership. One of my favorite examples is there's this great magazine cover with 50 Cent and Kanye West supposedly in a feud, and the person who owns the magazine also owns both of their contracts and distribution. So, I don't know who they're feuding exactly with. So there's only 5 companies that control nearly everything we read, see, and hear, including hip hop. Please get involved with some of the reasons that she's talking, some of the reasons that it gets closed down, why the downfall that we all see. If you have more questions about it, you can all come talk to me later about it. But I work for an organization called Free Press. You can go to freepress.net and find out more. But there's lots of other organizations doing work. So get involved. If you love hip hop, don't just... It's by independent people, do all those things, but get involved with the causes.
Yeah.
Fight back. There are people doing things. There's great work being done. So, thanks
again.
Thank you. That was a brilliant presentation. Appreciated it tremendously. My question is about what I didn't hear you talk about in your book, but I'm assuming that you've done some of this work. In these conversations, I'm always surprised and somewhat depressed that we spend all of our time focusing on the examination of our internal culture. And that creates a huge space for anonymity, in particular regarding those very specifically responsible for our social abandonment. And I don't hear that being articulated in the academy when we're talking about hip-hop. And I think it's patently unfair for us to spend all of our time and all of our resources and all of our energy deciding who's more appropriate, Grandmaster Flash or T.I. Where are the names? Where is the accountability? Who did for industrial divestment? Mm-hmm. For creating a situation that Joe Show beautifully portrays mm-hmm. in those photographs? We celebrate Mel Rosenthal for taking the photographs. There's an absence of scholarship surrounding who specifically caused these situations, not just in the South Bronx, but But if this situation is playing out globally, at least in the 400 urban centers in the United States of America where African Americans form the corpus of these impoverished neighborhoods, why are we not talking about them?
That.
You said corporations numerous times, but there's been no names associated with that.
Okay, well, let me try to answer that. First of all, I list all the corporations and repeat them, you know, vociferously, but I'm not doing it here because, you know, I figured it would work as a good placeholder. We all should know that if you know what the five companies are. I mean, I can happily repeat. In fact, every chapter begins with three or four epigraphs that quote people who articulate that position. And I use, when it's, you know, the sort of keeping it real, you know, the big corporate bigwigs do that. They'll say, I'll give, you know, they say things like, you know, we may not like what we're hearing. You know, this is to justify what they promote. We may not like what they're hearing, but this is just a real condition. It's a real situation. Philip Dowman, president and CEO of Viacom. Although we take our standards and practices role seriously, we also believe that it's not our role to censor the creative expression of artists whose music often reflects the pain they've suffered or seen in their lives and communities, right? So they're making an excuse. Now, in terms of the academic, let me separate out the notion of corporation from the academic trajectory of hip-hop study. I mean, my book spends a whole lot of time on deindustrialization and the post-industrial city as the origin of the genre in many ways. Mark Anthony Neal's work does that. Jeff Chang's work does that. There's a bit of a generation gap. We're tragically the old people, and it's tragic for many reasons. But, you know, there is a generation shift to what I would call the aestheticization of hip-hop, which is in many ways useful and important to do aesthetically sophisticated work. But at the same time, it feeds into the celebrification factor. Well, what's the really subtle difference in the style of this artist versus that one, which is usually driven by markets, and then becomes sort of this kind of comparing the artist scenario. So I would guess I would beg to differ to say that that work has been done. We need more of it. But it's been done. But the way I would say it could also be better done in the interest of your concern is that, and this was why I asked Mark about the hip-hop studies question, which isn't his fault, he was asked to talk about hip-hop studies, but why I think that really should be rejected is that it makes it very hard to get at these questions in a more systemic way. It makes it easier to bring in cats to the class that wouldn't otherwise come, but I teach one hip-hop class, but I really, really where I think I do the work that should be a prerequisite for that class is in my Black Life in the City class, starting with migration and developing an understanding of the formation of Black urban communities, starting in, you know, really 1915, moving forward in Chicago, New York, Detroit, L.A., you know, and talk about what that means. That sets up the conditions of who's responsible for what and the history of forced urban segregation in space, which is really what has produced northern ghettos. Housing covenants, laws, police containment, and the support of policies that also economically discriminate, the funding of white flight, all of this is really sets the groundwork. That has to happen to understand it. Now, like I said, I did it, so I don't know who, you know, I feel like I'm already on the same page with you, but this aestheticization of art as somehow separate from society is part of a tradition of Western legitimation practices. We talk about opera that way, right? Opera's an incredibly interesting form when you historically situate it. It's actually more interesting when you do that than when you just talk about shifts in voice. So we need to avoid that. There's a politics to that approach that I think we need to resist, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't celebrate the aesthetic complexity of what's going on. I hope that, I'm trying to go quickly because I know other people have questions. Is that grab?
If I can just add one more piece. I was asking a little more specific. We attach names to the artists. We attach names to specific locations where losers were situated. We talk about the oppressor.
Well, we don't always do that. There are activists who are very specific, and you know, when they go sit out in front of Deborah Lee's house, and there are several people here who are mentioned. You think about, for example, Byron Hurt's amazing film, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. He's interviewing people at BET. They're on camera talking. People have names. But it is both important to, and I said the same thing about rappers. You notice that I said, look, I'm not interested in critiquing one rapper over another per se. There are some that are more responsible for this than others, but the real issue is what's the iconic power of that trajectory? It's the same thing with corporate America. It's not about Stephen Hill by himself at BET. It's about a corporate agenda. He gets fired, someone else fills in. So we have to look at the politics of the process. I mean, I think naming's important, but I think we get caught up in the individual too much. And in a way, that can be used against us. It's like what happened to Kanye when he says George Bush doesn't care about black America. And he got caught up in the wrong conversation about what George Bush actually thinks, when George Bush's policies make that abundantly clear. And had he said these following policies that happen to be profoundly supported and enacted by George W. Bush prove the absence of care, now the media would have to respond to, oh, well, what policies could Kanye be talking about? Right? You see, so to me, there's a politics to grounding it not in the individual, even though we should name cats and they should take responsibility on all levels.
I want to thank you, first of all, for your willingness to bring up this point about our willingness to engage in affirmative love but not transformational love, and ask if you could link that, particularly your notion of people who are in corporate media spaces. And the yep. need to do that. There are a whole lot of us who are nowhere near corporate spaces.
Isn't that true?
Who are engaging only in affirmative love and refusing to engage in transformative love on any level. I'm wondering if you may or may not see a similarity in the way in which, for example, white Marxists have refused to talk about race and the accumulation of capital and therefore the resistance, mm-hmm. as well to the way in which we've refused to critique hip-hop
Yep.
in a transformative way, and what our unwillingness, and this could, I suppose, apply to either white Marxists or those of us who study hip-hop, what that means for the limitations on the way in which we approach creating social change.
Huge. That's wonderful. It's very tough. I mean, you know, Richard Wright talked about this a lot in Native Son in some ways, and also in Black Boy in other ways. Really, this tension, a certain kind of, it's all over the literature in many places, but a kind of seemingly progressive but really ultimately conservative form of paternalism. Right? That looks like it's embracing through some other means, but there is a fundamental refusal in it. And there's a number of people who've written on this, even in the way the left is critiquing identity politics at the same time as it's, you know, trying to support anything black in the interests of looking like it's radical. I mean, it's a bigger problem. I think our problem isn't getting courses taught on hip-hop, our problem, you know, in terms of thinking about this, but literacy about Afro-diasporic culture, politics, and tradition. The literacy about that is incredibly thin. Right? And if you don't have that, hip-hop can't make any sense. It just can't make any sense. Nothing else makes sense without that. And once you know that, then all of a sudden these pieces fit in. And most white Marxists don't know that either. And therefore, race becomes a subset of class. And they're profoundly intertwined. I mean, blacks are the most capital-oriented people, right? They were capital, so they get that. There's no challenge to the Marxist principle about capital, and exchange value. But it is about being able to see multiple trajectories at once, because in addition to them being terrible on racial aesthetics, they're also terrible on gender. And the field is terrible on gender. And I don't mean here including women or excluding women. I mean a gendered analysis of the tangible value of aggressive black masculinity as a product. Like, what is it about the incredible fascination with aggressive, violent black masculinity? What are the fantasies about? So, somebody needs to do that book. I'm really looking forward to it, And, how that plays out and how often young people participate in it because it's their capital, right? It's why young women participate as Roxanne was saying, this shouldn't be what women are valued for. The fact that women participate in it because that's how they get valued. The shorter the skirt, the higher the heels, the better chances they have of being wherever it is that they think celebrity is happening. The terms of that exchange are deeply troubling. Everybody's complicit in it, and we need more gendered analysis about that. We need a greater understanding of class. And this is a very interesting problem, that we could have the field go on for so long and have so little of that. Now, there are feminists who've done work on this, and Professor Neal talked about that, but a lot of that is also still about figuring out how to get women into the story. And I want to hear about the politics of gender and space. Why creativity that women are responsible, why women are pushed out of the places that are creative. When I interviewed a lot of the early both MCs and dancers, all of them talked about spaces that were pretty homosocial, that girls were not all that comfortable in, and that has to do with the way the public sphere is masculinized. And that's really important for how unintentionally women are pushed out, how heteronormativity pushes out queer artists, because the assumption is that there's a certain kind of sexual exchange and a set of values that are part of the bonding process. And unless we think about that, we're not aware of it and able to unpack it as well. It's not intentional. This is not, you know, like people are evil, and it's often the nicest, best people you want to be around, right? So this isn't about the them, it's about the us. And it's really at every level. And so, yeah, Marxists are a one bunch, but I got other fools I want to be mad at too. But they're on my list. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you. It was an excellent lecture. I guess I have less of a question and more of a request for you to comment on something.
Sure.
In terms of changing the status quo of the content of contemporary hip-hop, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of spoke about the choice, you know, between not choosing what the capitalist agenda is.
Mm-hmm.
And what came to my mind was a line that Jay-Z had in one of his songs, and I can't quote it exactly, but it was sort of like, you know, he referenced Common and was like, you know, I can rhyme like Common Sense, but if my sense had that much in Common, basically saying like, you know, I can choose to rhyme that way, but I don't because
I won't make
any money.
I think that was Talib Kweli. I think the line is, you know, I rhyme as well as, what is it? Go ahead. Oh, it's both of them?
Yeah.
Well, you might have to get on the mic and spit that one in a minute. But is it Common or is it Talib?
He says music critics hate me because the industry ain't make me. Hustlers and boosters embrace me for the music I be making. I dumb down for my audience to double my dollars. Y'all criticize me for it, but all y'all holler. Truth told, if skills sold, I'd probably be Talib Kweli. Truthfully, I want to rhyme like Common Sense, but I sold 5 mil. I be rhyming like Common Sense.
Yeah. So, thank you. He can quote it.
Yeah,
so, you know, there's just still this factor that, you know, so many ghetto youth want to use hip-hop as
right.
a tool because
right.
they don't see any
Excellent.
Outlets in education. They don't see any,
yes.
you know,
yes.
it's still like, you know, sports or rapping.
Right.
So
right.
how
yeah, this
you know,
is right on the
that's
money.
Such a fun, like the bottom line of
it's the bottom line.
You know, so okay. I can't
I'm so with you. I'm like I get it. Like you can, I'm all with you.
Yeah,
now, here,
right,
here's
so
no, it's, it is the heart. I mean, again, I have to pick what am I going to do in 40 minutes? You know, but there's the whole one of the underlying threads of both why I chose to write again about hip hop. Because I really vowed I wouldn't again. And why I picked this particular point in the conversation is that we have remember there I said there are six principles? The other one is, a second one is, we live in a market economy, but the market economy shouldn't live in us.
Mm.
And basically what I'm saying is that, you know, black folks have been capital, black folks have been fundamentally exploited, most working people of all backgrounds and ethnicities have been exploited, but the question isn't the existence of that exploitation, but the degree to which you internalize its terms. Because you cannot get out if you internalize its terms. And so what's happened now is that, look, sure, kids want to get out of the ghetto. But I hate to, you know, not to be old school and cold-blooded, but junk was pretty much worse a long time ago, right? It's worse in some ways now, but in some ways it was worse 30, 40 years ago. Some ways it was better. And the ways it was better are the ways that I'm pushing. They had to do with the idea of a collective politics that somehow produced disdain for those who exploited others in the community. Yes, they were always there. But the hustler and the pimp were not primary, you know, Halloween costume icons. Right? They weren't the icons for, you know, ideal masculinity. You know, if you wear a suit, they'll say, go ahead, pimp. You know, like somehow, you know, you're most cool when you're a pimp. Now, again, I know it's casual language, but it is partly about the elevation of the figure of the hustler as a model. And the hustler has to hustle somebody. And he's not hustling Donald Trump. He's hustling you. He's hustling me. And my only choices are what? To hustle back or to get hustled. So once that rhetoric is in play, there's really no way out except to break it. So what I'm saying there is, look, money's to be made. But how much money? Jay-Z had enough money 3 records ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, enough money for what? I mean, what exactly is the goal here? So there needs to be conversations about that. You know, personal accumulation of wealth as a global phenomenon, let's discuss that. You know, why is the idea that because there are people who exploit and I'm on the short end, I should flip the script? I should be on top. Well, let's actually have a different conversation. And that's what I'm hoping through this notion of creating progressive consciousness. Because what I think's happened is that progressives have been so locked in battle with the right wing that they've left the next generation with no critical tools for how to develop the progressive spaces that they need. Now, some already have it, but some don't. And that's the knowledge that needs to be passed on as well. And that's, I think, really the major lesson of the pioneers to me is that, is what is that space that they cultivated. So it's more about saying, look, of course money needs to be made. And our role as consumers and as, you know, writers and thinkers and whatever else we do is to make meaningful commercial space so that artists aren't being pressed into this trinity. So that they can make money. It's a perfectly legitimate thing. Everybody needs to survive, but not in ways that destroy community itself in terms of what it perpetuates. So that's partly our responsibility, you know? And I really think that we can't talk about global consumption of hip-hop with this level of illiteracy and not be worried, because that's how we got the ghetto gangster pimp ho trinity, was by, you know, I mean, I cannot tell you how many kids talk to me as if, you know, the ghetto is Disneyland. It's like it's a playground. Now, anybody who grew up anywhere near one will tell you straight on up ain't nothing funny about it. You know, you have people who love you, so you have good memories. Ain't nobody not trying to get out. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? But the fetish is about presenting like this is the fun place to be. And that's what's selling because of this illiteracy factor. They think, I mean, I have literally many, many students who think that ghettos are just ghettos because it just so happens that black poor people live there. Like, they just picked a neighborhood. Like, they said, you know, I think I'm going to move to the ghetto because I got peeps over there. You know, like, they had a choice. And part of that is this, again, this devaluing of a progressive politics from the spaces where they're the most powerful to be determined. So I'm not against making money. But I am against, you know, a sick level of accumulation. And philanthropy won't undo it. There's a chapter on that, too. Philanthropy doesn't, you know, blood money. If you spend all your time basically selling out the community and you give 20% back, I'd rather you didn't make it. I'd rather you spend that energy having done something. You could do more for the community with that 80% if it was doing something else than this 20 that you claim you're giving. So, I mean, I think it's very important to have a high standard. We're not all going to make it. Shoot, I don't barely live up to my own principles. But you're working toward them. That's the point. So it's not about who's in and who's out. It's about, and as Roxanne Shanté said yesterday, which I was just one of my favorite things of all time, was, you know, I'm where I am today, right now, but I'm going to be somewhere else tomorrow. Right? So I'm saying everybody can get involved with this. This isn't about, you know, one person having a certain politics.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. You're welcome. I love that question. It's like the heart of the whole thing to me. As I expected from you.
We're going to take just two more questions, one on this side and one on that side.
You can take, I'll talk to you after, no matter what. Sorry.
Professor Rose, a wonderful talk. My question is sort of unintentionally kind of a follow-up to the other two, and it has to do with space and also how we look at hip-hop as a whole culture. Mm-hmm. And the question is, if part of the problem really has been this sort of fixation on simply just the musical aspect and particularly the MC, and I mean, one of the things that I'm thinking of are the types of really incredibly complex discussions, say, Sophia Quintero, who writes mm-hmm. as a black Artemis that Mark Anthony Neal is talking about in her book, Picture Me Rollin', that mm-hmm. really talks, that really brings this very rich intergenerational type dialogue and actually covers a lot of very tough issues about both women and men's relationships, or the types of critiques that that a lot of the women doing spoken word poetry,
oh, yeah.
but which is very much infused by the hip-hop aesthetic bring. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question really is if the failure to actually take a more critical look at some of the other work that's being done that's been influenced by it being a much larger culture and much more pervasive, you know, is almost ghettoizing and actually narrowing the type of discussion that mm-hmm. can occur.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I think that there's a lot of discussion of those spaces. I mean, maybe I'm running in different intellectual circles than you are, but my sense is that that's where a lot of the intellectual energy is, which is brilliant and wonderful. I'm not against, you know, I think that work is fabulous, and I use it, and I rely on it. You know, so I'm all for this idea, but, you know, both the question of spoken word, the transformation of hip-hop dance into various other types of dances, what Wilfredo was talking about in terms of reggaeton and all this other transformation. Of course, culture's in motion. We can't reify one moment in time and think it's never going to change. But at the same time, I actually think that the best way to make space for that is to clear out this huge, profound space in the middle. And that space is the corporate domination and definition. And if we don't tackle that, it's just going to keep expanding. It's going to be like, you know, when people try to harvest the earth, but they, you know, what is that process where you keep planting and you don't give a certain rest? Crop rotation. If you don't properly do that, you can't build anymore. So they're just basically, you know, destroying the earth for other creativity. And so we need to curtail that, the sort of, you know, deforestation of the rainforest type of politics. And so I'm doing my work right there. There's a lot of people who, first of all, I've done enough of the aesthetic historical origins work, and there are brilliant people doing all this other stuff. What's not happening is how to push that space so that young people can make different decisions. Because it's really about how you make decisions to consume or not consume. That's going to have a huge impact. But the real question is, how do you build the consciousness to make those choices? How do you make the manipulation of the funk a problem? Right? How do you transform your sense of expectations around community building and gender identity? So that's crucial work, but I'm actually saying I think that's where most of the work is. Most of the work's not where I'm talking about, not in the scholarly realm. Unless you, I mean, I'm happy to hear if you think I'm totally wrong about that, but that's just my perspective. Does that follow your sense of it, or do you think there's a lot of work on this space from this perspective?
I guess I was thinking of it more in terms of coming from the critics, primarily conservative critics.
Yeah, well, but see, I'm arguing with them too. But that's exactly my point, that they have done this work and have prevented a progressive discussion. Like, there are progressive grounds to be against hustling that understand the origins and circumstances. You see what I'm getting at? Not a conservative one, but a progressive one. And we don't have an argument because they've taken the territory, so now all we do is defend. What can you do? You got to hustle. Well, wait a minute. Hold on. Time out. There are other options here with all this energy and aggression and attention that could be politically cultivated. That's what the Black Panthers did. You know, it's not to be like the first time. So I hear you. That's my point, is really to pull us away from this kind of injured, you know, attacked consciousness that makes it hard to do that internal transformation. Because I really do feel we're locked in opposition with the wrong, you know, they can play that tape. They've been playing it for 100 years. You see what I'm getting at? I'm like, okay, all right, we heard that. What do we need? What do we want? I mean, what was one of the most radical things about civil rights activism was creating small freedom schools that had everyday people sitting around asking not just what they don't want. They don't want Jim Crow. They don't want lynching, obviously. They don't want discrimination. What do you want? If you don't envision what you do want, then you end up in a defensive stance, perpetually holding on to whatever's left and never asking for more. You know, and that's what I'm hoping to do there, is to say, look, I know the conservatives and I beat the hell out of them, trust me. But I also say, there's something to be said for behavior. It does matter how you act. She wasn't like, it doesn't matter. But it doesn't matter above and beyond or in isolation from structure. Of course it matters that we treat each other with care, concern, love, dignity, and possibility. How could that not matter? If it doesn't matter, we don't need Africa Bambaataa to do the work he's doing. And of course we need him because he says it matters. That's what Cool Herc has said from the beginning. That's what matters. So we have let other people insult us about that rather than taking it up ourselves enough as a progressive politics. So I'm hoping it works. Maybe I'll wind up looking like a hater. But you heard it here first. That's not my agenda. I have to bring a tape of the talk and, you know, attach it. But, you know, I think it's a hard thing to break people out of. So I appreciate you raising that. I do. All right, sorry about that, huh? Ira.
Hey. How are you? Professor Rose, thank you very much for your critique and your comments. I guess right now I'm having a real emotional moment, because how appropriate is it that we have pioneers in the room who can speak to many of the things that you described, who can help give us answers to many of the questions that you raised in your talk. And I guess what I'm curious about is the folks who are in the room, who are pioneers, please, I would like to hear you come forth and talk about your critique of the critique. You know, because we are here in the academy, and how often do we have an opportunity like this to engage the people whose craft is it to talk about everything that you described, right, and more, and there, and whatever's missing from that critique. Right. And so I really want to hear you guys who are in the room, who are pioneers, please say something, because we can't leave this room, we can't leave this space without your voices having been heard, particularly since this is, you know, this is the last academic panel.
Yeah, I'm to talk about anything. It doesn't even have to be.
Of the first conference of this kind. So please.
But it's also the beginning. It's the last session at this conference, but we hope this is the beginning of a conversation and a discourse.
Yes. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate that. Yeah, please.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good afternoon. I just wanted to say that I think this dialogue is important, but just like so many things that have happened in our culture, and I mean black culture, from music to entertainment to literature in the past, the actual artists, pioneers, forefathers, or whatever, are usually don't have a voice as far as... Once they lay down the foundation for this culture, let's say hip hop, for example, I'd like to hear Kool Herc. I'd like to hear Afrika Bambaataa, and along with the academic, I think there needs to be a balance between people who were actually here. I mean, if I could talk, if I wanted to talk about cars, you know, I'd love to talk to Henry Ford. You understand what I'm saying? And if I had the chance to speak to Henry Ford, and as opposed to the Mitsubishi Corporation, you know what I mean? I'd much rather talk to Henry Ford and get his take on this whole thing. And I think we can't really have a true dialogue or go on to find solutions to some of these things without finding out the mindset of these pioneers and these people who actually, like, that's me up on that poster, okay? So I'm saying we can sit here, and I'm not going to be around here forever, but it's up to us and the academic side of the conversation to kind of find a medium between what is actually real, what we actually lived, what were our actual motivations and circumstances which led us to you know, to be in this position, to capture this, to start out some art form. I know there's been a lot of conversation about the times of the 70s and the state of New York City and the Bronx at the time when hip-hop was born, but if you wasn't there, and you weren't living during that time, and you really don't, you know. My point is, I don't want to ramble. I just think there needs to be a balance in the conversation between academia and the actual people who actually were there and did this thing. And I think we can meet somewhere in the middle, and cover the whole scope as far as finding out answers and solutions to some of these questions and some of these problems. And that's why I'm glad that we made it to come in here to hear you speak, because people like you and some of the other people that I've encountered here inspire me. I want to come to that level. I want to graduate to that level, and I want to teach posterity, okay, firsthand information about those times, about what led us to come up with this culture in the first place. We know that we didn't invent anything. Everything's a reinvention of things that already existed. And hip-hop has happened so many times before in our lifetime. Not in our lifetime, but in history. Mm-hmm. So this is just our version. Mm-hmm. This is just our reinvention of these elements that already existed. And we need to take a more active role in coming to things like this and in the educational process as far as people teaching hip-hop, teaching classes, and people learning. I mean, you can learn and research all day long, you know what I mean? But for somebody that was there to actually come in, take an active role, and to help educate the next generations, and not just educate students, but educate scholars. You know what I mean? Because you got people teaching hip-hop that they just learned hip-hop.
Yeah.
They didn't live hip-hop. They learned it.
You know what I mean? Right. So, I mean, I thank you, and I know I appreciate you. And like I said, other people like Jeff and these guys that write books. I want to hear more from the Cool Herc and the African Bambaataa and the people that can put some kind of balance.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. What I'm hoping is that the space I'm trying to make and the critique I'm making about the public conversation would make room for that. Why isn't there a permanent sort of ongoing interview with pioneers in Source Magazine? They're not waiting on academics to give them a direction. They've got their whole own world. Why aren't they doing a monthly, you know, conversation with pioneers that takes 5 pages? Why didn't Vibe do it? Why isn't there a website with all the money involved in hip-hop that some artist who's just made $10 trillion says, I want all the pioneers documented? Why isn't, so this is, you know what I mean? So it isn't just, it's not, what I'm saying is that the conversation, because it's so trapped in the public area, that those spaces are hard to make. So, you know, when Melly Mel makes that critique, I think it's the BET Awards, where he goes off about the history of hip-hop. I think it was the BET Awards. I can't remember. Hold on. I don't want to lie. During the induction to the Hall of Fame speech, where he went on, you know, a long time talking about the loss of what was important in hip-hop. How come nobody's following that up in the public arena? Well, that's not because I'm writing a book or because of Jeff Chang. That's because the public conversation is dominated by corporations and a lot of rappers are complicit. And they don't make the space for this pioneering conversation. So that's what I'm hoping to do, is make room for that, as well as, of course, in the academy. Not just the early beginners, but people, you know, there's a lot of folks who started hip-hop in other places. I mean, I'm from the Bronx, too, so I get that. But, you know, there are other places that need to be honored and understood. And they need to be asked questions, too. And new performers need to be asked questions about what they can and can't do. What are the pressures on them? So we need a ton of information from the artists, from the dancers, from the everybody. And scholars, by all means, don't have that. Our job is to help get that information, to put it in places where everybody can share it. But we also have to deal with this notion of the media, because that's where most young people are going. Most people aren't going into the library to find an archive. Let's just be honest. They're not. Most people are waiting to hear it on VH1 and BET and MTV. And if we don't blow open that space and make the right space there, you will continue to be unjustly buried.